Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, October 29th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, RCEA reverses rejection of nuclear power. Fugitive Joseph LaRue evades capture, girlfriend arrested on accessory charges. And Ukiah received an F for fiscal management, but the score does not tell the whole story. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The National Women's Law Center, NWLC, and Anna Nuslock, a woman denied emergency abortion care, identified in a high-profile lawsuit against Providence St. Joseph's Hospital, responded to a pending agreement between California Attorney General Rob Bonta and the hospital. The agreement would require St. Joseph to comply with state laws mandating emergency abortion care, a development stemming from accusations that the hospital illegally denied care to Nuslock and others in similar crises. K.M. Bell, senior litigation counsel for NWLC and Nuslock's attorney, expressed mixed feelings about the hospital's commitment to abide by California law. Bell called the agreement a welcome development, yet stressed that it does nothing to address the harm already inflicted on Nuslock and others allegedly denied care during medical emergencies involving pregnancy. Citing court evidence, Bell noted that Providence St. Joseph has refused emergency abortion care for miscarrying patients at least 3 times in recent years, with a local doctor estimating the hospital denies such care once or twice annually. Bell underscored the risk of allowing hospitals to, quote, hide behind religious policies, end quote, at the expense of patients' health and safety. Nuslock, who alleged that Providence denied her critical care, stated that she and others would be closely monitoring the hospital's compliance. She expressed gratitude for the community support she has received and encouraged others who have faced similar denials to come forward. Her case underscores ongoing concerns about the balance between healthcare providers' religious policies and their legal obligations to provide emergency care, including abortion, when medically necessary. Keep it tuned to Redwood Community Radio as we continue to follow this story. The Fortuna Police Department announced that they have arrested 3 juveniles for the vandalism and theft of property at Rohner Park in Fortuna. Police Chief Casey Day shared the details of the arrests and damages incurred.
The Fortuna Police Department made significant progress in a September 4th burglary and vandalism that occurred at the Rohner Park Pavilion, resulted in the arrest of 3 juveniles. This incident involved forced entry through exterior doors and windows and extensive interior vandalism, structural damage, graffiti, and damage to storage areas, offices, and property inside the pavilion. Repair costs were estimated at over $28,000. In addition, about $500 worth of property was stolen from the facility.
Surveillance footage of the juveniles in commission of the crime proved invaluable to officers during their investigation.
The Fortuna Police Department conducted a comprehensive investigation utilizing CCTV footage and other evidence to identify the suspects. These arrests demonstrate the department's ongoing dedication to protecting public resources and maintaining the integrity of our community safety. As a matter of department policy, the suspects' names are being withheld due to their status as juveniles, but each was booked into the Humboldt County Juvenile Detention Center on charges of felony burglary and felony vandalism. 3 arrests were made on October 25th.
Chief Day expressed the department's commitment to protecting the community's resources, like the parks, and shared appreciation for those that have stepped up during this unfortunate incident.
The Fortuna community values our parks and these spaces, which bring quality of life for our families, and we will continue to aggressively pursue those who commit crime and damage or destroy the park, city facilities, and other community resources. The Fortuna Police Department remains committed to protecting these assets and ensuring a safe environment for everyone. Personally, I would like to express my appreciation for the patience and support of community members and for the assistance provided by local construction professionals who actually came in and helped us assess the damage. I'm grateful to those who helped in the evaluation and documentation process, as well as to the public for standing with us in our efforts to hold those responsible accountable. I would also like to thank our partners, Fortuna Parks Department, as well as other city staff members who worked diligently alongside our investigators to bring this case to a close.
Juvenile crime rates for vandalism and destruction of property tend to peak during early teenage years, often declining as individuals approach adulthood, with contributing factors including peer influence, lack of structured activities, and unsupervised time after school hours. Chief Day encourages parents to help guide the youth in respecting community assets, as well as highlighting resources for youth in the Fortuna area.
Yeah, I think as a parent, I would encourage other parents to just, continue to have ongoing open dialogue or discussions with your children. There's absolute value in teaching our children to respect all things, and especially the things that we all value, our parks, public resources, and shared spaces. And, just getting out in front and teaching our youth about the importance of taking care of the community's resources helps prevent incidents like this and just kind of builds a stronger, more connected community. And so, as parents, we're involved in so much, whether, it's your day job or just parenting or, you're coaching a little league team. Those are all opportunities to get out in front of, our kids and other children, our youth, and, just be a mentor and a coach and teach these children valuable lessons early on. As far as programs within the city, we are fortunate to have our school resource officer funded by the county's Measure Z. And so, our SRO spends a lot of time within the Eagle River Valley schools talking to children about, and our youth about, just kind of an entourage of things. And, obviously this is one of them. Our parks are in such close proximity to many of the schools within the city limits of Fortuna that it does, kind of become more of a responsibility for our school resource officer. And obviously patrol is going through there, daily and nightly, but there's some crossover with kids, taking their breaks or coming and going from school and stopping in the parks. And it should be a safe space and a community asset that is appreciated and celebrated by all.
Community engagement plays a crucial role not only in preventing crime, but also in assisting law enforcement in solving cases and deterring future criminal activity.
With this incident, I would just like to say that, the department encourages anyone with any further information related to this incident or any other similar case to contact us immediately. Community support remains an essential part of our mission here at the Fortuna Police Department in our effort to protect public spaces and ensure a safe environment for all.
If you have information about this incident or any other criminal activity in the Fortuna area, please contact the Fortuna Police Department at 707-725-7550. Tips can be reported anonymously. In a turnaround, the Redwood Coast Energy Authority will accept nuclear power from the Diablo Canyon plant. Daniel Mintz reports.
Reversing course from a previous decision, the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, RCEA, will accept nuclear power in its energy mix, with added revenue from it possibly funding local projects. The October 24th RCEA Board of Directors meeting revisited a debate on whether to accept nuclear energy from the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Customers statewide and locally are paying for the plant's operation, which has been extended to at least 2030. Last month, the board voted to reject the nuclear power. It was a close vote, and several board members were absent. A procedural glitch triggered the do-over. During a public comment period, Arcata resident Joanne McGarry urged the board to stick with its original stance.
I've been against this from the get-go in my college days at Abalone Alliance when we went down there protesting and having Jackson Brown and all these people sing songs. And you know, nuclear energy is not the future for me, and conservation is. And we as people in Humboldt County need to really recognize that we can do it differently, better. We don't need this blood money, in my opinion. And I was in Santa Barbara for 7 years and 5 fires, by the way. And got to know these group in San Luis Obispo, Mothers for Peace. For years, decades, Mothers for Peace has been working to close down Diablo Canyon. And I looked at their website yesterday. Diablo Canyon is full. It's falling apart. We should not be supporting that operation in any way whatsoever.
Those in favor of accepting the nuclear energy say energy agencies, including RCEA, are paying for the Diablo plant's operation and might as well get the benefit of its power, which is considered carbon-free. Accepting it will also provide an additional $500,000 of revenue each year. The RCEA's Community Advisory Committee recommends accepting the power. Committee member Deborah Dukes, who is also a member of the 350 Humboldt Carbon Reduction Advocacy Group, said she's not in favor of nuclear energy, but rejecting it in this case won't accomplish anything.
Nobody consulted me on whether we should pay for the decommissioning of Diablo Canyon. Had they asked me, I would have said no. I would have said no. However, I'm paying for it. And I'm as unhappy about that as I am about my CalSTRS pension being invested in fossil fuels. For the same reason, I don't think we should turn down the allocation. We're paying for it. We are not going to make a difference in how long the nuclear reactors go. We're not going to make a difference in what the PUC decides. We're not going to make any difference in what PG&E decides. I think we can take that money, just as I take my blood money, and use it in more constructive ways.
RCEA Board Chair Sarah Schaefer is Arcata's representative, and she said many people there have told her they don't want RCEA to include nuclear power in its energy mix. Schaefer said if it's accepted, the added revenue should be dedicated to local renewable energy projects.
And really, you know, not seeing a direct route, or at least in this, you know, particularly recommended motion of, you know, moving the way that I think we need to, which is like, how can we become more independent from G&E, for example, have more of our own resiliency and independence with energy where we're not reliant on resources like the Diablo Canyon, and being able to bring online our own resources and projects locally. So, you know, I would be inkling to support in the back of my head if there was, you know, some clear direction that money could really be spent locally in our community and the savings could be brought to us. But, you know, that's not necessarily what I'm hearing as a possibility.
Responding to the concerns, board member Chris Mobley made a motion to accept the nuclear power with what she described as a caveat, that the added revenue from it be separated from the rest of the RCEA's budget and considered for specific uses like funding local projects. The motion also included revisiting the decision every year. With that, a 7-1 vote in favor of accepting the nuclear power was gained. Schaefer cast the lone vote in opposition. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The hunt for fugitive Joseph LaRue is now focusing on northern Humboldt after he was recently spotted in Eureka. Initially wanted for felony animal abuse in Oregon, LaRue has managed to evade capture multiple times, most recently following an alleged domestic violence incident in Redway on October 15th, in which he reportedly sustained a gunshot wound before fleeing the scene. Despite initial fears that he may have succumbed to his injuries, recent sightings confirm that LaRue remains alive and actively eluding law enforcement. On October 26, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office responded to a tip that LaRue's vehicle was spotted at the Safeway on Harris Street in Eureka, according to HCSO's Public Information Officer, Meg Ruiz.
There was an incident on October 26th where the vehicle associated with Joseph Miller was spotted in the Safeway parking lot, the Safeway location in Rica. So deputies responded to the area, and we essentially can confirm that Joseph LaRue did flee from the Safeway on Harris Avenue in Eureka after deputies did respond. And we arrested Katina Baker, who was harboring a fugitive, Joseph LaRue. She was committing child endangerment, and she was in possession of a controlled substance, paraphernalia, and a firearm.
HCSO deputies ensured that Baker's infant child was safely transferred to family care prior to her arrest. Though LaRue was last seen near the 2500 block of Harris Street in Eureka, he is known to have associates throughout the county.
It's possible that he's anywhere. We had deputies search the area immediately after this incident occurred, and he wasn't located in the immediate area right after that, so he could be anywhere, essentially.
Authorities are urging the public to remain alert, as LaRue's capture remains a priority.
He is still outstanding, and anyone with information on his whereabouts should call the sheriff's office at 707-445-7251.
For a photo of Joseph LaRue, please visit our website at kmud.org. Turning to Mendocino, KZYX's Elise Cox digs into the California Policy Center's analysis of Ukiah's finances with Finance Director Dan Buffalo to understand why the ranking doesn't accurately reflect the city's financial health.
Ukiah has the unhappy distinction of ranking last among all California cities for fiscal management based on a set of objective metrics pulled from audited financial statements. I interviewed Lance Christensen of the California Policy Center to learn more about the ranking, and then I spoke with Dan Buffalo, the finance director from the city of Ukiah, to learn the story behind the data. It's a surprising one that illustrates the importance of asking questions to gain a deeper understanding. In that sense, this is a story about why local reporting matters. To get us started, here's Lance Christensen from the California Policy Center.
I think it's helpful to start out at the very beginning. All of these cities required by law, especially if they receive federal funding, to report an annual audit report that goes out and basically verifies that the money that they're getting in is being spent appropriately. They're saving the right kinds of money, you know, reserves, various accounts, business versus non-business accounts, restricted versus unrestricted accounts. And it's a very complicated document, often hundreds of pages long, and they often analyze apples to apples. So if you go from one city to another, you can take, you know, the amount of revenues you're getting in from different tax sources, and you can compare those to apples to apples. It's the same thing with other obligations, bonded indebtedness, pension funds, or other expenditures that you have. So starting as that as kind of the even table for everybody across the board, what we did is we took and we looked at all of the data for each one of the 402, as you said, cities that reported. We had less, I think it was around 46 counties, I believe, that reported their data. Not all the school districts did, most did. So what we're doing here is we're doing a comparison. We're trying to make it apples to apples. We're trying to say, when you look at these various categories in the different cities, how are they doing when it comes to important measures for their health score? And this is an average that's not scientific, but it's just, we're trying to get as close to possible or to close to some sort of equal look at these jurisdictions as possible.
With that understanding, we turn to Dan Buffalo, the finance director for the city of Ukiah, and we ask him for his take on the city's score.
So this appears to be a relatively new platform or reporting tool done by a third-party entity here, California Policy Center. We weren't really aware of it until my city manager brought it to my attention. This looks like it might be the second year in which they were reporting data. And it's being pulled from our audited financial statements, otherwise known as an annual comprehensive financial report. So the city does do that, prepares that report and issues it. It's audited, and the audit opinion is basically saying, yes, the information presented in here is materially correct and so forth. And when it was brought to our attention, yeah, it was obviously very disappointing to see because it certainly doesn't properly or accurately characterize the city as a whole. It appears to be focus primarily on the general fund for the city and all the cities it's comparing to.
There are at least three things that skew the numbers, Dan Buffalo says. The first is that Ukiah's budget is much bigger than the general fund, which is the city's discretionary account. This is the money that's used to float grants to pay for infrastructure projects. And to be clear, when Ukiah gets grants, it still has to advance the funds itself until they're repaid by the state or federal government. And that brings us to the second thing. Ukiah is currently engaged in roughly $100 million worth of capital projects. That's about 14 times what the city holds in the general fund, according to last year's financial statements.
So what they're picking up here in our reserves is our reserves have been depleted temporarily while we're cash flowing these projects. But they're presenting it as like, well, they're just low by their calculation, and therefore that's a failing grade. So the context is there's a reason for it.
So the city looks dangerously overextended, but it's not. Finally, the third big hit that Ukiah seems to be taking, according to the center's ranking, has to do with how it handled pension fund losses during the financial crisis. When interest rates were very low, Ukiah sold $40 million in bonds that it then used to reduce its unfunded pension liability.
So we were pretty happy that we were able to do that. That saved a lot of money for our citizenry. But we have a relatively high debt burden irrespective of our pension obligation, most of it being very deliberate.
These deliberate decisions are the ones that Ukiah is getting dinged for.
And to the point that the two things that I think are really dragging the city's score down have nothing to do with even the intermediate or long-term viability of the city. It has everything to do with short-term cash flow driven by the city's deliberate strategic attempt to procure and then execute on grant-funded capital projects, predominantly capital projects. And all of, again, not all, most are expenditure-driven, meaning you have to spend the money before you get the reimbursement. Those things will change in 2024, and I would expect this report would be probably considerably different for 2024.
For KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox.
In state news, we turn to our partners at Pacifica Radio for an interview with UC Berkeley politics professor Eric Schickler, who breaks down logistics and worries around voting in the current political climate. Christopher Martinez reports.
I think that there are a number of reasons to be worried, one of which is the Trump campaign's efforts to delegitimize the vote count. And, you know, making claims of fraud. And so if it should happen, for example, that he's ahead on election night, he may very well or is very declare victory. And then when more ballots are counted and it shows Harris hypothetically, you know, ahead, you know, he will claim that that's a matter of fraud and try to undermine the results. So that's one thing to be worried about. I think that the examples of ballot boxes being targeted in drop boxes in the Northwest is a reason for concern in terms of sabotaging the vote, creating uncertainty, potentially in a very close race, throwing the results in certain communities. So I think it's just a moment where we have good reason to be worried about a smooth election.
And we do have the example of 2020, where Trump was trying to get directly involved in some of the state elections, right?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of reason to expect a repeat of 2020 being tried by Trump if he does lose the Electoral College, and that would then put a lot of pressure on local and state election officials. Some of whom will be in states that where there's a Republican legislature that might well step in to try to help the former president. And so I just think it throws things into a level of uncertainty that that prior to 2020 just was not a routine part of our politics.
Let's talk a little bit about the swing states where it's going to be razor thin in some cases. Are we expecting like maybe to wait a day or two to find out results in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think it's quite possible. I mean, results will be coming in and there'll be efforts to project the remaining vote. But, you know, one of the features of election law, for example, in Wisconsin is that they can't open the ballots from absentee voters ahead of election day. And so they can't really get it organized so that they get counted as quickly. And so, you know, I think in states like Wisconsin, you know, there's a good chance that the, you know, the results will still be coming in into the next morning. I mean, and so we just won't know. You know, in the case of a very close election, which seems likely, there's also a very good chance we won't know who's coming out ahead in the Electoral College, you know, possibly even for a couple days. I mean, hopefully by sometime Wednesday morning.
Are there clear advantages with machine tallies versus hand tallies in these particular cases?
I mean, I think in general, you know, for election security, having a machine tally but with a paper backup of votes is generally regarded as the most secure and least error prone. You know, if you require, for example, all ballots to just be counted by hand, that takes an awful long time and will tend to introduce, you know, more opportunities for error to happen.
Let's talk a little bit about the poll worker situation. It got pretty ugly in the last election. People's lives were threatened and their lives made miserable. Is this a concern that we should be thinking about again this time around?
Yeah, I certainly think it's a concern. I mean, we've had a number of local election officials basically decide not to stay in office because of the harassment they were facing in some of these communities, especially more rural communities. And, you know, I think it's just good reason to worry that there'll be efforts at intimidation and harassment coming from, you know, Trump supporters in, you know, if the outcome is not going in his direction.
We've even had some situations where people have showed up armed and kind of hung around outside polling stations, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there've been instances of efforts to intimidate voters. I mean, I think in the past, generally, election officials have been able to enforce the rules in ways that limit that, at least in the, you know, in this kind of modern voting rights era. You know, I think there is certainly just more cause for concern that that's going to happen everywhere this time.
All right, Eric Schickler, I want to thank you very much for your time this afternoon. It's been great.
Glad to be with you.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Elise Cox, and Christopher Martinez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see related stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Musick.